Greetings, everyone. Bruce Merrifield here with webinar number 3 out of 11 in a total series. If you want copies of the slides that I'm using today, down here it says request a slide deck. You just send me an email, bruce@merrifield.com. By the way, if you search for me at LinkedIn under my full name here, you'll find me, and I'm happy to connect with anybody to where I put, you know, 2 or 3 times a week, sort of a curated post with commentary about the onrushing electronic commerce cloud digital transformation challenges. I think disruption is just going to continue to increase and be the constant sort of concern we all have in traditional channels of distribution. Today, net profit analytics basics. So what I'm going to do is not kind of get into the deep weeds of, you know, cost to serve modeling at the line item level and so forth, but just to sort of introduce you to really a new world. You know, when Einstein came up with his theory of relativity, that opened the door actually for a group of guys to come up with what was called quantum entanglement or quantum mechanics. And in it, there was spooky entanglement is what Einstein said. So he went to his grave, Einstein did, saying, no, it can't work. It doesn't make sense. And he was always looking for something to connect the two, the unified theory. And, you know, the next generation said, well, you know, whether you can understand it or not, it works. In other words, for your cell phone, they use 6 different quantum mechanic applications to make cell phones go up to satellites and back and so forth. So, you know, it's a new world, and you get to name new pieces like quarks and leptons and things like that. So it's a bit, for some people, quite confusing. And so we're just going to look at this new world, and we're going to come up with some vocabulary and some basic building blocks to understand the sort of the upside potential. Then in the next 3-4 webinars after that, I'm going to dive into specific cookbook how-to recipe kind of plays to apply these new tools. You can read the uses here. It just, without a cost to serve model, distributors unwittingly accumulate a lot of losing activities, losing picks, losing orders, and systematically losing customers. It gives you nothing but small dollar picks and orders that don't have enough margin dollars to cover your activity costs. Then because of the busyness of taking care of all this losing activity, when you say, hey, let's go spend some extra time and energy focusing on the customers that really are quite net profit or could be even more so, we never get around to it because we're so busy losing money, spinning our wheels with customers that are never going to change. They're always going to, you know, it's basically little customers giving you retail-sized orders, and then you're giving them wholesale service cost structure and wholesale prices. No wonder these little guys are loyal. And so we've got to figure out how to deal with this so we can redirect our energy to bigger payoff opportunities. And the people who are currently incented on just getting more sales or getting more margin dollar volume will fight, not all, but generally speaking, will fight these new insight plays that come out of net profit analytics, even though the upside gains for them and everybody would be great. You know, when you say, I've got a vision, I'm going to expand the pie, and it's going to make all stakeholder groups, you know, employees, customers, suppliers, and shareholders richer, richer, richer. People say, well, I don't understand what you're talking about. I don't really see it. And I fear that, you know, I'm going to be less well off. So therefore, I want the status quo. Let's just keep doing what we're doing. So education is the cure. Let's move on to the next slide. Just some warm-up thoughts. When you have a new perspective or a new lens, let's say you are Galileo and you hear about microscopes, so you think, well, wait a minute, I'll make the lenses the other way, and it'll become a telescope. And with 1 week, he created a telescope that was 80 times more powerful than, you know, normal vision. And he immediately said, I'm going to look at the planets, these wandering stars, to realize they're not stars. They don't blind you. They're just big balls. And oh my gosh, Jupiter's got little moons going around it. So we don't know what gravity does to keep moons going around, but, you know, da 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 da, et cetera. So you open up a new world with a new set of lens. And that hopefully we have the humility and the curiosity to say, well, wow, who knew? This is really surprising. Makes me wonder what else we don't know Are there unknown unknowns? We don't know what we don't know. Another reaction is, oh my gosh, how embarrassing. We have customers we're losing enormous amounts of money on, and we thought they were really key, vital, terrific customers. That's embarrassing. It's happening on my watch. Or, hey, I'm the sales guy on that account. I'm getting $3,000 in commissions, and we're losing $50,000 of the account. I don't really want to see this, and I don't want to believe it. So let's keep the status quo. Look, no one else is doing this. Let's just keep doing what the herd is and getting crummy returns, eating dust, following everybody else doing what they're doing. But if you ask all the employees, would you like at the end of the year more real compensation, health benefits, real raises, et cetera, they go, yeah. Well, then don't we have to grow gross margin dollars per full-time equivalent employee, FTE? Don't we have to grow that somehow without working harder? We want to work smarter. How are we going to do that? Then we realize, oh my gosh, we've got this electronic commerce cloud challenge that's growing. Where are we going to get the time and the money and the courage to sort of reinvent ourselves, unweave our current business and selling models and reweave new ones? I mean, isn't innovation, in a sense, the only choice? So I want to start off by just sort of comfort zoning the new paradigms, sort of statistical math reality, and then we'll get into Net Profitability Analytics 101. So here are four lenses. We all look through the financial lens all day long. It's a 500-year-old paradigm, starting with, balanced double-entry bookkeeping in 1494. It's survived enormous evolution with accountants out the wazoo to sort of make sure our company complies with 10,000 lines of tax code here in the United States. And the whole driving force of that is you better pay the right taxes to the right, political entities or you're going to jail. And then the balance sheet basically just says, I've got some assets I can borrow against for working capital asset-backed lending from the banks. That's it. But because that's all we have, that's all we use. And looking in that one lens, we can come up with, great insights like, hey, if we raise prices 1%, a lot of that incremental margin dollar pounds the bottom line. So sell high. And hey, if we chisel our suppliers by 1%, that all pounds the bottom line. So buy low. Of course, these are zero-sum win-lose propositions. Hey, customer, I got a great idea. I'm not gonna change anything I'm doing for you. No, I'm not going to increase, innovate, value, whatever. All I'm really going to do is just raise prices so you can make a little less and I can make a little more and we can be partners. What do you say? They go, I'll tell you what I say. We have to buy from at least two. If we're big enough volume to keep three guys on the hook, we'll buy from three guys. And we'll check prices every day, every week, every month. But periodically, we're going to check prices because we know you're trying to sneak them up. And on our side, we're trying to buy low. So after 50 years of trying to sell high and buy low, creating mistrust with both sets of partners on your vendors and your customers, how's that working for you? And yet every year everybody talks about, sneaking prices up and so forth. I'm not saying not to be pricing efficient. I mean, if you can raise prices and nobody notices or cares, and you can make some more money on dust collector items or whatever, by all means do it. So don't undercharge for what you're doing. But then a second big lens here on the right here is order size, math, customer profit analysis. That's really going to talk about today. But from that, we'll be able to create profit and loss statements for aggregations of customers. Like all these customers are of a certain type, and therefore they tend to have a common one-stop shop in-stock fill rate need of items. Compare, we have other niches that buy some of the same stuff, but they buy other stuff too. And because this niche is similar, if we went out and sort of investigated them a little bit more, we would understand that, these guys have one or two little service metric needs that are different from other niches. And we need to do that to be able to be the best service value proposition for that particular customer niche. And then the fourth one is, well, wait a minute. How do you take a new paradigm and start looking at customer-centric solutions as opposed to let's push product from the number one commodity vendor that's going to give us the best rebates? I'm not saying an either-or thing, but and also how do we rethink our business to be able to take advantage of all the insights that come from number two? So let's move on to the next slide. here's sort of my progression towards order size economics. I got out of business school in 1974, and you know, my boss was building a chain of primarily printing paper distribution companies in the Midwest. Had one losing location. He said, look, just go up there and figure it out. And, you know, you go up there, and I mean, they've cut costs to the smithereens. They're hiring them cheap, and they're working them hard. And, you know, it's just not going anywhere. They're on the fourth branch manager in 5 or 6 years. So, you know, I'm just a curious kind of guy. And so I said, well, I'm just going to hang out with different people for a whole day or half day to just see what their job and their world is like and what, you know, information I might be able to get from them. So I'm out on a route with a driver. And, you know, he had 10 deliveries to make, and three of the deliveries were to these little hole-in-the-wall, you know, mom-and-pop kind of operations. And, you know, he gets off, and he can hand-carry a little case of something to them. Hi, Mom. Hi, Pop. Here's your case. And I'm thinking, there isn't enough margin dollars in this little order to cover the cost of stopping the truck and the driver, let alone picking it or line item, you know, order entry, you know, et cetera. You know, this is crazy. And I said, well, how often do you stop? Oh, every week I deliver, you know, this same little package to the same little business. And you look at these people and think, well, they're self-employed. They're not entrepreneurs. They haven't grown in the, they haven't done anything new or different in the last 10 years. They haven't grown in the last 10 years. They're just getting older and more tired. Eventually they may implode. So I thought, gee, what if we have a lot of, you know, today on this particular route, we 3 out of 10 deliveries were to, you know, not growing anywhere, little creatures. What if we have more of these guys? So I went back and I did some quick math. I said, all right, I'm going to take the total transactions for the year. Last year, I'm going to divide in all the sales for the year, all the margin dollars for the year, all the costs of running the business for the year, and the operating profit we didn't have when it was they were losing money. And so I'm going to come up with an average sales per transaction, an average margin dollar per transaction, an average cost of serve per transaction, and an average loss per transaction. So at least I had some benchmarks. So let's just say, imagine that the average cost per transaction was $100. I mean, back in 1974, it was probably like $25. And then I just took a register to look at all the warehouse delivery orders. And 70% of all of the orders were below the average, some of them ridiculously so. So anyway, well, I thought, well, I've witnessed, you know, 3 out of 10 where we had nothing but small customers who structurally, systematically are going to give us nothing but small orders. You know, we can't be, you know, giving them free delivery and these kinds of we got to change the terms and see if they'll still want to do business with us. So that was sort of the beginning of what I was doing. Notice at the bottom I've put down here, really what I was doing unwittingly was following the scientific method that Galileo invented, that we all took in seventh grade math, where, you know, you make some observation, but you got to be curious first to sort of open your eyes and say, well, this looks weird or suspicious or whatever. You start asking questions, then you start inventing measuring tools. As I did, just get benchmarks by taking, you know, total transactions, dividing into the total sales for the year before, whatever, and then going and looking at a transaction register, which was not sorted from high to low by margin dollar per stop or, you know, order delivered, but at least I could eyeball it. So I'm starting to, you know, sort of rapid prototyping, refining my capability. You know, Galileo invented a telescope, and he worked, you know, after the 15th iteration in 1 week, he had an 80-time thing, and then he started using that new tool. And then it comes up with new theories and so forth. But it's interesting, what you find out immediately is what received wisdom assumptions and lack of curiosity and greed prevents this. In other words, I came in with fresh eyes, with fresh curiosity. This has been going on for years. So I did a crude, you know, customer profitability ranking report, you know, ranking report 1.0, you know, figuring it'll get better over time. So I just took for each customer the GP dollars they had for a year. Then I took the total number of transactions they had for the year, and I multiplied it by the overall average cost per transaction. Very crude. And then what was left over would be an approximate operating profit. The key is the ranking report. The only way you could be at the top of this report is to have a ton of gross profit dollars and very low transactions. And intuitively, you know, well, that's got to be a profitable account. At the bottom, the only way you can be down there was actually, shockingly, I didn't really think of this, I was just looking at little customers, to find customers that actually had, you know, a lot of GP dollars. But they had like 250 transactions. So they were killing us. You know, their cost to serve still was much greater than their GP dollars for a big loss. Now, people immediately said, oh, the model stinks and whatever. And I said, look, we could do any of this model at all. And the extremes, the very most profitable guys and the most unprofitable guys, would still be winners and losers. We can, we refine the model and it'll jostle them around. We can knock number one down to number four, but he's a winner. And why? And let's go keep them and get more people like them. And the losers, they're losers. Why? Because even though we know they're a loser, we don't know what they're thinking as far as why they're buying, you know, small amounts every day as opposed to why don't you just buy us once a week. So the pushbacks from this just were insane. So I put in here a link that will take you to an exhaustive list of objections and then very thoughtful answers to all of them. And, you know, stuff like, gee, little customers grow into big customers. Acorns grow into mighty oak trees. And when you look at all your minnows, you realize that maybe 2-4% do. And they're easy to pick out because they got all this energy and ambition. They're trying new stuff. They're innovators. Whereas 95% of them are just self-employed. And they haven't done anything differently or new in a long time, and they're not going to do anything in the future. So they're just structurally a retail account that we're giving wholesale services and prices to. The sales force won't stand for it. Well, let's do some math and figure it out. And it turns out that, you know, some guys had, you know, the bottom 50% of their accounts were only giving them 10% of their margin dollars. Most of them weren't, you know, big enough to support an outside sales call relationship. So I literally went to some of the sales guys and said, look, here's what's going on. No bad guy here, whatever. And I didn't sort of accuse them of not even calling these accounts, just getting their numbers on it so they could get extra commission. Why not? Type of thing. I said, you know what? I'm going to buy them from you. So here's a check for what you would make on these guys for the whole next year. So now I'm going to take these and give them to the minnow division. We're going to put new prices and terms on them and try to make them profitable. If maybe they run away, but that's their choice and paralyze our competition. But I'm going to you and I now are going to hyper-focus on the top of your report and do better with key accounts and or new prospective accounts. And together we're going to I feel confident that we're going to, you know, more than make up what you gave away with these little minnows. So there are plenty of objections and lots of answers at that place. So when you hear the model's not perfect, let's keep the status quo. Brings up some thoughts about, first of all, what's an optimally complex model? In other words, you can't ever have perfection. You know, your audited financial numbers, they're not perfection. If you had three different auditing firms do your books, they'd come up with three different sets of numbers to send to the IRS. You know, everybody, you know, let's not assume there's something perfect in a dynamically ever-changing, moving around, wiggling world with lots of variables. So all you need is something that's optimally complex, so it isn't a pain in the butt to sort of maintain on an ongoing basis. And it lets you, here's a key point, which is it's a strategic decision tool that you're using to focus your energies in the right places and fix things which are clearly, you know, losers or profit drains. It's not an end of the year, the accounts have to come in and find things you did wrong to justify their ridiculous fees that they're charging you for the little annuity they have taking care of you for, you know, tax purposes. Also, if you have a model at the stock keeping unit pick level, then you're able to find, you know, different groups of big losers, and you can zero in on exactly why they're losing and come up with more solutions where you can liquidate unnecessary. They have lots of buying activity, losing costs, buying tiny little dollars of stuff over and over and over again, as you do. So by consolidating those things, you both actually save money. And it's a valuable service you can provide to customers. And you basically can identify exactly how much unnecessary noise or friction is in every replenishment process you have with every one of your customers. This particular slide just shows year over changes. All these slides come from Waypoint Analytics clients, where it's in the cloud service for net profit analytics. And Waypoint uses a concept or a term called NBC, which stands for the net profit, but before compensation. So you get down here, and the only thing left to subtract before you get to profit is the incentive comp that might be attached to that particular account. So what this report has done is it's compared the went back, let's say, to 2018, and it said, what was the NBC for an account? Then what was the NBC last year? And it contrasts the two, and it comes up with a difference. And then it just ranks all of the accounts from the account that's up the most by NBC so here are the top 10 out of 3,000, and here are the bottom 9 out of 3,000. Now, this is a company where, you know, at the end of the year, the economy grew 2% and they grew 3%. So if you sell everybody in the marketplace, you're selling the economy and you're going to do what the economy does. But the fact that all these numbers are aggregated, rolled up, hidden, in financial numbers, you don't realize that there are, a small percent, 5%, 10% of your accounts at the top are way up, and 5-10% of the accounts at the bottom are way down. So there's a lot of hidden volatility. So at any rate, you can sort of think, oh, well, look, we had lots. Well, in this case, here's an interesting example. You were losing a lot of money because you have Waypoint. You went to work on that account, and you were actually able to reduce the losses, the activity costs, really, by an enormous amount. Goody, goody. Here, there was actually an increase. Here, there's an increase. But basically, all these accounts at the top, you're like, wow, that's a lot more business, but we didn't hire any more people. Where do we get the slack, to take care of all the extra phone calls and picks and packs and chips and everything else and paperwork in the back office, et cetera? And the answer is we go to the bottom of the report and we say, oh, here at the bottom of the report, the look at the bottom nine and say, wow, here's a guy that, was doing, a certain amount of business and doing a lot less, type of thing. So because we lose here, that frees people up to take care of these accounts. So whether you knew it or not, your people, if the phone doesn't ring because bottom number nine guys aren't calling, it's number 10, top 10 guys are calling. So you take that call. That's just what people do. I mean, they react through the day. And, if you have a little less business, that means I can get back to the customers that are still with us a little quicker, a little more thoroughly, whatever. So people don't think that, if I got rid of one account, then they're just going to sit. And we're all sitting here and we get the same fixed costs. No, the energy is flowing around. So now we're into net profitability mechanics, terms, concepts. First of all, the idea of a profit equation. So the idea here is if you look at a P&L, so here's my mouse. You can look at the GP dollars, and you subtract the total cost of running the business. You're going to come with some operating profit dollars. The gross margin percent overall that you happen to have for your company, that's an emergent object. It's just a phenomenon. And there is no correlation between the margin percent of all of your branches and the pre-tax return on total assets for all of your branches. I mean, you can find a guy with a high margin percent, but they have a zillion little orders where the actual costs are even higher than the margin percent. So you can have a profit equation for the whole company, but you could also say this total year-end P&L is the sum of 150,000 or 1,000,005 of line item pick events. So if we could somehow push the P&L, the sales, the margin dollars, whatever, down to the line item pick level, so that when you've got 150,000 or a million, profit equations at the line item level, and you add them all back up again, you would get the year-end P&L. And then we're going to learn a little bit of whale curves and so forth. So let's just move to the next slide. So here is at the top, let's say you've got an overall profit equation for your company. It's a $10 million standalone location. Your gross margin dollars are randomly running at 25% of your sales total. Your cost to serve is randomly running at 22% of your total sales total. So your operating profit is randomly running at 3% of sales. So we then push all of the sales, the margin dollars down to each individual line pick level. So let's just hypothetically imagine we have 50,000 line items. So these are sort of micro profit equations that add up to a macro. Well, once we have these 50,000 line item things, we could say, well, we had 5,000 stock keeping units that had picks last year. So let's rank all the SKUs by profitability. So now what happens is a computer goes and finds there's 147 picks for one SKU. So it goes and finds 147 pick, you know, line item equations out of this pile, adds them all up, and comes up with sort of a summary profit equation for that SKU. And then we rank all the SKUs from high to low. And we could then say, well, wait a minute, we could take a supplier, take all their SKUs, get the profit equations for all of those SKUs, and come up with a P&L for every supplier. We could do it for product groups, et cetera. We could also go over here on the customer sort of side and say, well, these 50,000 add up to 20,000 orders, and we had 1,000 customers, and one customer had 50 orders. So we're going to get the 50 profit equation orders, add those up, get a P&L for the customer. We get all the customers in a given niche and get a P&L for a niche. We could add all of the customers in a sales territory and get a P&L for the sales territory, and so forth. So once we've done that, you know, we start to discover certain stuff. So, for example, overall, we find out that there's an enormously high correlation between a customer's average gross margin dollars per invoice and their profitability. You know, if a customer's very profitable, it doesn't mean they didn't have some small orders and some small picks that you lost money on, but on average, the margin dollars were much greater than the cost to serve dollars in their invoices, so they actually made an operating profit. We find that an account, typically like a house account, small minnow, mom and pop, or an SKU, like a $2 little widget that we have a 50% margin in it, well, 50% of $2 is a dollar. And if you said, what's the cost of humans picking the warehouse all in, you realize, gee, I can't even pick at the warehouse for that. So you find out that margin percent is actually inversely proportional to profitability. I know this is a total shocker, but generally speaking, most accounts and SKUs that have high gross margin percent averages are losers. And surprisingly, ones with low ones are winners. We'll come back to that multiple times. Down here, I come up with a term which I call gross margin percent myopia, which is universal within distribution channels. For 500 years, we've been thinking about buy low, sell high, and then we'd say that would mean I'd have all things being equal, which they aren't. If I could have a fatter margin percent, I'd make more money. And that's true if nothing changed. You know, but if you raise prices and customers leave, or you get a monster direct order, which is enormously profitable, but has a low margin percent, that would drag your average margin percent down, and you would think that's the wrong way to go when, in fact, your profits are getting bigger. So everybody does it. As a result of it, people are, you know, enchanted with house accounts that have high margin percent. They're enchanted by, you know, little geeky SKUs that have high margin percent. And they tend to overprice direct shipping orders. So most distributors actually make enormous amounts of operating profit on direct business because they're afraid to even go lower on the margin percent, because they just that's the way we think. And also, counter business is enormous, typically very unprofitable. And of course, you know, if you just said, well, wait a minute, let's benchmark this, for example, against the cost to serve structure in terms at Home Depot. I went with an electrical wholesale guy. We pulled into Home Depot. He ran in and got two items out of the electrical area, which got 3,000 of the most popular electrical SKUs, and then self-scanned it himself, swiped his card through, and he was back in his car all in under 5 minutes. As opposed to the pileup of people you see at the counter at first thing in the morning, and people behind the counter running around self-picking for the customers, like a 1920 grocery model with human beings with exploding healthcare costs and so forth, you know, picking the equivalent of one AA battery for the guy, putting a plastic bag, printing a barcode, sticking it in the bag, scanning that to get into the computer and say, all right, you know, here's your small dollar pick, and let me go get five more for you, type of thing. So at any rate, and then if you look at sort of like a Fastenal model or W.W. Grainger store, you know, you can pull in, park there, but you go in and help yourself. And, you know, the margins are running at 57 to, you know, 80% kind of thing. So And then Amazon, they might be happy to take small orders and even lose money, but they're happy to get the clickstream and here are other things you can buy. And we're going to monetize your clickstream. We're sell advertising. And they've got the world's most efficient, low-cost, you know, warehouse fulfillment anyway. So, you know, distributors have to sort of realize that they have an infrastructure service cost reality that's not conducive to taking care of small orders. In the Waypoint universe, when you look at distributors in 60, 70 different channels, statistically, out of the warehouse, 70% of the line items picked are losers, 62% of the orders are losers, 30 to 60% of the customers are losers, 20 to 50% of the sales territories overall are losers. Doesn't mean there aren't profitable accounts in there. We find that vendors, there are a few big net profitable vendors, and then there's some that are big and may give you a lot of rebates, but because they're selling bits and pieces kind of stuff, it's the kind of things you're picking $1, $2, $3, $4 picks all day long, you know, very popular, highly picked, but not enough margin dollar for each pick, you know, cost to serve pick that we've got. So when you start to look at how many losers you have to start to think of in terms of allocating overhead costs. A lot of people say, hey, we're all here, all of our costs are fixed, we're not going to fire one person or one-tenth of a person tomorrow. So really, in the moment, real time, it's all our costs are fixed. And I see that guy over there, he's probably doing Facebook or something. So let's get some more orders coming through these phones to keep these people busy. You know, busyness is productivity and, in theory, profitability. Not realizing that statistically, we have lots of full-time employees doing nothing but taking care of losing volume. So this idea that we only have one more small order we're taking care of is not the case. You know, we're getting killed, overwhelmed by but people, humans don't like to they don't like to look at bad news. So there is a concept, a business concept called affirmative inquiry, where what you do is you sort of say, well, let's, you know, yeah, okay, fine. We've got a lot of losers down here at the bottom of the report, but let's look at the very best. We all like to look at the very best. And how did this happen? And tell me the story. And everybody takes credit for the winners. So a pop term for affirmative inquiry is sort of bright spot management. So we're going to focus on bright spot management first. This is just nomenclature. These are what are called whale curves. When you have all of the line item profit equations, you can say, all right, let's take every single line item equation. So in that one case, we had 50,000. So there would be 50,000 little data points on this curve right here. And we would start off with the number one most net profitable line item event. It could have been a direct order for $100,000 that had $15,000 of margin, and it was a house account, so there was no commission, and we had $300 of paperwork, so we made a lot of money on it. So we would have an initial big pop for that first one, second one, third one, fourth one. So we're basically starting with going this way from the biggest winning profit equation down here to the biggest loser. And down here, we probably have a credit, you know, where we reverse charges for, you know, some ridiculous amount on a pricing extension or something like that. And all this really sort of is this theoretical thing to say that our peak internal profit for this particular company was $15.5 million, but their operating profit was down here at about, $2 million or so. But here's what's interesting. The line item is not what I call actionable. You know, it's interesting data. But if we went over here and we looked at the SKU whale curve, so now what we're going to do is take the same 50,000, or this guy has like a $50 million distributor, so he might have $1.5 million. So we take this $1.5 million line item profit equations, and we sort them all out by SKU, and then we add up profit equations for the SKUs. So what we do here is we take the number one most profitable SKU and put their profit going up the y-axis. We take the number two most profitable SKU and stack that on top. And so we get up here to a peak internal profit of about $10.5 million. Notice it's different than 15.5 because on SKU picks, you could have 100 picks and maybe 80 of them were profitable, but 20 of them were small picks and you lost money. But if you average them all, add them all up together, it's still it's net profitable. So there's a canceling out or a dampening effect. But what it does show you typically, and this is very common for distributors, is that they're going to have a handful, 5% of their items out of the warehouse that make all the money. They have a lot of dust collectors, you know, that aren't doing much, and they have a handful that lose a lot of money. And then all, because every single line item profit equation is in here, ultimately you're going to wind up at the tail of the whale. It's always going to be the operating profit on the macro year-end P&L. And what this suggests is, gee, why don't we make sure we're not ever out of stock on these items? Why don't we beef the winners? And over here, the losers are, you know, little very popular nuts and bolts where they're picking a little, you know, rubber washer we buy for 10 cents, we sell it for 50 cents, we make 80% margin, let's do high chest bumps over that puppy. I mean, that line from that vendor, oh my God, that's a 50%, you know, supplier, you know, line, that's awesome. But of course, it's a zillion little picks in the warehouse where the human cost of just picking it, forget packing and shipping and all the other stuff, it's underwater. So the, you know, how do you solve these items? Amazon calls these items crap items, which stands for can't realize a profit, obviously, you know, a double entendre there. So there are sort of a range of solutions we can come up with for sort of consolidating or ameliorating, reducing the losses we have on little SKUs. But that isn't as actionable as the customer whale curve. So here we do the same thing. We take all the profit equations and we put them in little bins by customer. Actually, we sum up the orders and we put the orders in the customers to come up with P&Ls for the customers. Then we can take our number one most profitable customer, put their profit here. Then we take our number two customer and keep stacking them up. And again, you see a very small percent of the total customers, in this case about 10% of the customers, are giving us $8 million in operating profit. We have a lot of customers that they're break even. I mean, they could be really big or really small, and the margin dollars and the cost of service is a wash. And then down here, we're going to have the tail of the whale. We're going to have customers that are always large in sales and margin dollars, but intergalactically huge in small dollar picks and small dollar orders. And this is when we see this, we don't like seeing this. Or he goes, oh, I don't believe it. The model stinks. I mean, this is a big account. Everybody wants that account, da-da-da-da-da type of thing. Here, the intersection of profitable customers and profitable items. You know, if you have a very efficient, effective, no-nonsense customer, and they are going to buy, you know, and I should say, the profitable SKUs are always popular. They get picked a lot. They are always big ticket items. Think $1,000, you know, water heater, you know, $1,200 4-ton furnace, you know, some kind of 800, well, a skid of, you know, consumable stuff, towels, copy paper, whatever. So when people buy it by the whole skid, you think, gosh, you know, you can't make much money in this. Our margin percent, if we think in terms of like a 20 to 35% range, you know, this is competitive, so we have to charge 20%, 19%, 18%. Oh, you can't make it. You got to have 18% to make it out. That's received wisdom. Everybody knows you need 18%. Well, what's the order size? If it's $10,000, 18% is $1,800 of margin dollars. That's going to cover a lot of activity costs. Whereas if you have a $10 order with 50% margin, that's only $5 of margin dollars. That is not going to cover pick, pack, da-da-da-da-da with a little overhead and so forth. So the popular profitable items are also shoppable. That's what you showroom at Best Buy. That's what you web room from distributors. So smart guys are going to just routinely check to see online if you can buy some of these super popular high-priced ticket items for less than you can. So you say, here's last look. And you go, well, I can't meet that because, you know, if I did, these winners have got to pay for all the losers. And if we give away all the cream on the winners, then we're just losing, losing, losing. So it's the intersection of these best items that also come from the smartest, you know, sharpest customers. They're going to start to leak profit out. In fact, I put a little story down here Going back to, like, I don't know, the first quarter of 2017, Grainger announced that their sales were off 2%, but their profits were off 20%. And basically what happened was they tend to have, you know, stock all kinds of things, and they tend to make a lot of money on cases of tape or, you know, commodity items. Well, in that first quarter, a lot of customers started to check at Amazon and say, wait a minute, I can buy the cream item for less at Amazon, so I'm going to split my order. I'm going to spot buy shoppable web room kind of items from Amazon, and I'm going to go buy the goofy little oddball item that Grainger has from Grainger. So Grainger then had to get competitive on, you know, the top 1,000, 1,500 most, you know, the left-hand side of the curve here. The my mouse just keeps jumping around here. So they had to get more competitive on these items. So the next quarter, the good news was, you know, they had stopped sales erosion. The bad news was, because it just cut the price, their profits had dropped even more. So this is going to be a constant stress on your business model. These are four whale curves. The 2014, 15, 16 is from one customer, one Waypoint client. And if you went and said, who are the big winners in 2014, 2015, and 2016, 8, 9 out of 10 of them are exactly the same. If you said, who are the big losers, 8, 9 out of 10, year after year after year, are exactly the same. And what it just says is customers have their way of buying. No matter how functional or dysfunctional it is, they just keep doing what they're doing. And the, you know, so that good for the winners, but on the losers, how do we go out and say, hey, we have new data that suggests there might be ways we could work together to reduce hidden, unnecessary, lose buying activity costs and lose selling activity costs. And here's what's going on, and here's how we could correct it. And ideally, what we'd like to do is to convert some of these guys from being big losers to being big grateful winners. Like, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. You are right. That is going to save me a lot of activity. It's going to improve my uptime because, you know, we stock out, and guys can't do what they're supposed to do because they don't have what they want. So you're right. I get that. And, you know, while we're doing there, we ask for more spend, and maybe we get it. So we're going to try to, you know, shorten the tail and increase the head of the whale. And one guy did that. Here's an example of a guy who had a curve look just pretty much like this one. He went to work and converted a lot of things. So what happened was, and I think, you know, maybe I'll find it here later on. I'll just tell you right now. He went from making about $1,500 in operating profit per employee, per FTE, full-time equivalent employee, to $76,000 in operating profit. Now, his margin dollars per head more than doubled, but most of that flows to the bottom line. He paid more to his sales force in commissions, incentives, whatever, but the rest, if I just turn my crank 15 times a day, but each time I take an order or I pick an item or I stop a truck or I do a three-way paper match, and there's 100% more margin dollar in the transaction that I'm processing, all those people just got twice as productive, but I'm not necessarily paying them anymore, and it pounds the bottom line. Of course, he gave out on average about $6,000 in gain sharing bonuses to everybody also. So maybe we should stop right now, take a breath, you know, go back up to 50,000 feet and say, oh, okay, so what's going on here, Bruce? Well, first of all, we're doing cost modeling at the line item level. Then we do ranking reports, and we look at customers, and we find that big customers with good sales and good margin dollars and maybe a decent margin percent are losers. We just freak out. We don't want to go any further. Stop. It's over. I don't trust the model, et cetera. All customers are good. Every damn margin dollar is good. If I lost one customer, one margin dollar, everybody's sitting here, so it's going to come out of the bottom line immediately. These are sort of received data-free wisdom assumptions. And you know, we say, well, wait a minute. The fact that some customers are super profitable or unprofitable, that's an upstream symptom. We still don't know what are the root causes, philosophies, of why our most profitable customer is so profitable, and what are the practices, beliefs, philosophies, you know, that unprofitable customers are doing, and where can we find an insight where we say, oh, well, wait a minute, you know, here's an opportunity. So, for example, with big losing customers, you realize I'm losing money every time I process this. Well, think of them. You know, if they have a human talking to your inside salesperson, that their human costs as much as yours. If you have paperwork, they have paperwork. If they have to take stock and order, you know, 2 cents worth of 52 different items, then when we ship it to them, they've got to receive it and go put that away for 2 cents. The more, if they buy it a lot of times on a just-in-time basis for like Q-tips, the odds that they're going to stock out go up. When they stock out, they can't be productive. Maybe you should have a little bit more inventory on Q-tips, so you're just never out of them, and then you can have productivity. And the productivity of the people is far greater than having a little bit more inventory. It's called a positive trade-off. Yes, we're going to load you up a little bit more, you know, inventory of spices in your spice rack, but you're always going to have it when you need it, as opposed to, oh, this upsets the whole dinner party because I don't have, you know, something to put in there. So the insights then lead to new plays where you've never done before. And it might take incrementally little different skills or vocabulary or whatever, you know, courage. So you try experiments. You don't jump in the deep end with, you know, both feet not being sure how you can swim. So then you have these new plays, and very quickly you realize the skills are not a big problem, and you can do that. But if you have the new plays, then you have to change the incentives. If you pay salespeople on margin dollars, they're incented to give away cost to serve. Let's have free freight, no minimum orders, free returns. Let's stock extra inventory just in case and they want to start buying from us, et cetera, because these things help win and keep margin dollars. Salespeople are just doing what they're paid to be doing. So we're going to have to rethink our incentives. But remember, we're innovating, so everybody's going to get richer. So don't freak out here. It's not a zero-sum kind of thing. And then this would require number 8, new kinds of tracking reports, because we have new innovation metrics, so we need new reports to track these things. And then it's all too scary, so we're going to do very small little baby steps. You know, in the Waypoint universe, you can actually start with one customer out of 1,000. You don't have to, you know, go, you know, top-down, monolithic, here's what we're all going to do tomorrow type of thing. Then as you start to do these experiments, you actually learn more stuff and new visions, new levels of thinking of your business, particularly in customer centricity, service value, innovation, start to come up. This slide just basically sort of says why are most profitable customers profitable and why are most unprofitable customers unprofitable. Under most unprofitable, you can see I put Tolstoy in his, you know, opening line of Anna Karenina through Anna Karenina, the character. He basically says all happy families are happy in the same way. All unhappy families, you know, find their own way to be miserable. So there's a big fragmentation of kinds of customers and why they're losing money, as opposed to the super profitable guys. Just one, they got to be really big. Two, they tend to say, you know what, just find the best, you know, distributor for us, marry them, and beat them up to fine-tune how they take care of us so we can always get what we want. We have a very disciplined rebuy system so that we have healthy order size as an average. We don't like to stock out and have emergency stuff and downtime. We don't like to issue purchase orders for $1 and $2 of spend. And so they're very disciplined about it. This slide just shows you that, you know, in the Waypoint universe, when you say, well, here's a big loser, and you want to do the 5 why analysis, well, why, and you keep until there are no more whys, just get to the root cause. Because it's a huge database capability, you can look through, you can right-click on a customer, and this little screen pops up, and there are 11 different lenses you could look at this customer. And then under the general customer tab, there's some other lenses you can look at as far as, you know, how they're behaving and what's going on. And by going through all of these things, and particularly if, you know, local, you know, salespeople and management and so forth know the account, as you go through, you go, oh, the light bulb goes on. You know what's going on here. Now, you can come up with pretty accurate guesses as to what's going on, but until you actually go out into the silo at the receiving dock or, you know, in this particular department where they bought, you know, a AA battery 415 times last year, one at a time, you got to kind of go out there and say, what are they thinking? I mean, ultimately, you don't know what's going on. And, you know, with your biggest losers on your biggest losing items, you just, it's great stories. You can't make this stuff up. But they're easy to fix, and then you get a huge savings on both sides of the fence. Generally speaking, again, stepping back to 50,000 feet, we want to basically try to rebalance our service energy. So right now, when the phone rings, inside salesperson picks it up, they're going to give them standard service. They may recognize a customer calls all the time. That actually may be a losing account because they're calling you 52 times a day with 52 little small orders or something. They confuse frequency with quality of profits, which is not typically the case. But at any rate, whoever calls next, we take care of that. It's first come, first serve. So we react. It's democratic. We give them constant speed service. It's 5 o'clock. We go home. So that allows us to give lots of attention to lonely little customers who call us up and want to shoot the breeze. Meanwhile, big profitable customers are, you know, electronically entering their orders, and that causes any friction costs at the inside sales desk. The field reps, you know, if they're still doing time and territory, I want to cover geography, and I want to call in the A accounts more often, the Bs and the Cs. And, you know, even if I'm not getting business from an A, if I get even a little business, I'm the number third guy there. I'm only getting 10% share of the spend. I'm going to hang in there because, you know, someday maybe number one's going to get hit by a bus or something, and I might move up in the pecking order, sort of a game of attrition. And it's all about, you know, drive time as opposed to where are you going to make the most net profit and dynamically so. In other words, if this is a customer that's growing very rapidly and we married them, they grow us. So even looking at the trend, you know, over a five-year net present value, you know, you really want to invest a lot more time and energy in a handful of accounts as opposed to I'm worried about covering a lot of accounts and being very efficient with my drive time. So we want to switch from, you know, let's give everybody good service to let's give, you know, intergalactically fantastic service to the very best net present profit value, most profitable, but some of them are growing very rapidly and the potential for, you know, more net profits is huge. So one way of looking at that is at the inside sales level, do you see dynamic service triage with heroic extra effort acts? So all inside salespeople are busy. Number two target account calls. You have an overflow, you know, capability. So if somebody picks it up, recognizes, because everybody has to know who the target accounts are by heart, that this is the number two target account. And this is, I'm thinking of a specific story where a gal named Sheila says, oh, just a second, number two, puts on hold, screams, number two target account on hold. Can anybody take the order? And an inside sales guy named Tony said, here I was talking to not a minnow, but microplankton man. And I realized if I just hit the button to take the number two target account, Minnow Man would call back later on because he always does, he's lonely. And then I could say, hey, what happened? I was talking and you just weren't there. Oh, Tony, the phone just went dead. He just said it was a faster way of blowing the guy off diplomatically than, you know, to get to number two. So then he said, hey, number two, what's up? What can I do for you? The guy said, well, I'm calling you late in the day because you've got the latest cutoff for next day delivery. And this is, I've got a huge opportunity to crack a huge account. And Tony said, we're going to make it happen. So Tony and another guy actually worked with this guy for an hour and a half till about 6:30 at night to not only make sure he got stuff he needed immediately for the next day, but to help him work on a huge bid that he then subsequently won. It's about $120,000 of hardware for us. And he said, from now on, I'm going to give you all my business. So that would be an example of all the employees knowing by heart the key accounts and being able to, you know, switch from, you know, being dragged down by a, you know, lonely minnow to giving extra effort where it really counts. So how do you switch from here to here? And another thing you find out is when you look at the range of customers, it begs you to have different kinds of service models and selling models. So here is a slide where a Waypoint client, their first year, the year that they started, this was the previous year's, this red one was the previous year's customer whale curve. So they're making about $500,000 in operating profit on about 3,000 active accounts over six locations. So they went to work and found friendly, you know, open-minded, big, you know, losers did analysis, figured out where all the super friction was, went out there and said, hey, look what's going on. Here's how we can make a fix for that so we both win. And those customers said, oh my gosh, that's fantastic. And they said, by the way, deep in the bowels of your company, we noticed we could do this, this, and this. Can we sell you that too? And they said, sure. So what they're doing is they're converting big losers over here to big winners. So you don't want to aspire to get your peak internal profit through a rearview mirror. What you want to do is convert big losers to big winners and get and earn more share and see peak internal profit go even higher. So you can see in 12 months, they cut their tail of the whale in half, and their profits improved from 500,000 to about a million, a little over a million five there. And then the next year, they did even better, but, you know, declining. I mean, you get the biggest wins, easiest wins here, and then they start to get a little bit more difficult. And not all six locations bought it. You know, there were three locations that really might be 70% of the business that were all over it. And there, but there are other managers who said, you know, yeah, I get it. And then they just weren't going to change. And so, you know, you're going to sort of deal, you know, with those kinds of reluctant folks. Notice also that their total number of accounts shrank. And what happened was they spun off all the minnows in a minnow division. They raised their prices, unbundled freight, said, you know, get to this. Here's a new strict minimum. But if you get even higher, you get free freight. And even higher, we'll start to give you, you know, overall order size discounts. So they gave customers an incentive to order half as often, twice as much. And a lot chose to do. But some of them said, I forget you. I'm going to go paralyze your competitor. Doesn't know you better. He thinks every customer is a good customer and every order is a good customer. So they left and paralyzed the competition. But that's okay because that freed up the slack that they needed to take care of these people over here, this volume over here, without adding people. That's why gross profit dollar per head doubled. That's why profits per head went up 15-fold for these guys. And that's why basically there was a all stakeholder groups. The employees got gain sharing bonuses, the 401k thing. The customers here were obviously getting better service. That's why they responded. Their business was growing like crazy. So the supplier said, wow, we love this. You know, you're growing like crazy. You're clearly doing all of our promotions very well. They didn't do any of the promotions. I mean, they could have. It's not an either or. But basically, they're growing because of customer-centric service value innovations. That's what's going on here. They are unique. No one else is doing this. That's why the head of the whale is exploding. And they don't need to hire more people because over here they got so much consolidation out of small orders and or little customers leaving, that they were able to redeploy it and get, you know, twice the size orders and so forth. And, of course, the shareholders made a lot more money and everybody's happy. This is the guy who basically, you know, went from having a big tailless whale to almost a perfect whale curve. A perfect whale curve, just for your, you know, amazement, would be one where the last customers break even. So it just, you level off and be zero, no up or no down. That would be a perfect whale curve. And you can see that he increased his sales by 75%. His profits went up 26 times. Profits per employee went up, you know, from about $1,500 to $76,000. Everybody could gain sharing bonuses and so forth. Great story. Now you're going to run into sort of egos, old beliefs, and incentives that will resist this. Most of these objections are taken care of in this little ebook that I wrote, footnoted at the bottom. Also, I recommend that if you go to my website at Merrifield Act 2, with just the number 2, not TWO, you'll see a tab for Core Customer Renewal Roadmap down here. And that sort of, you know, gives you a total general roadmap for how you're going to educate everybody as to what's in it for them. Now, you always say, hey, we're going to change around here. Really? Why? What's in it for me? I'm just going to get screwed. I'm going to get, you know, overworked or whatever. So, you know, education is the key. And so that gives you a nice summary way of going about it. And then just in summary here, net profit analytics opens up a whole new world. It has new vocabulary, new concepts, and out of that emerge insights and plays. We really do have to have the humility and the curiosity to say, what don't I know? And wouldn't it be worthwhile to know more and, you know, get statistically sort of fluent about these kinds of things? But do anticipate that big insights are what you need to get big, big change, big results. But proportionally, the bigger the insights and the bigger the potential results, the bigger the entrenched resistance will be. And so, you know, read through my little book there and so forth. And then in subsequent, the next, you know, 3-4 webinars, I'm just going to get into using these terms to then talk about very specific plays that will give you big results using net profit analytics. Thanks very much.